In a few minutes, South Texas author Noe Torres speaks about his latest book, Aliens in the Forest, The Cisco Grove UFO Encounter. An Edinburgh native, Noe has written 8 books about historic UFO cases, and his work has been featured on numerous radio and TV shows, including the History Channel. Let's welcome Mr. Noe Torres.
Okay, thank you all for coming today. We're trying to make events like this
Headline edition, July
something that's... let me hold on a second here on this. I forgot I had that audio triggering. Sorry about that. We're trying to make events like this more common here in the Valley. This is the first major UFO conference that we've had. And it all started because, you know, we saw how, for example, Roswell, New Mexico makes such a big festival every year in the summer, and it's such a wonderful event, family friendly, and people come from all over the world. So we wanted to have a little bit of that Roswell experience here in South Texas, and that was our thinking when I proposed it to the city of Edinburgh and the public library in Edinburgh. So we're very thankful and gratified for you all's support today. Okay, I'm going to be speaking today about my latest book, which is called Aliens in the Forest, The Cisco Grove UFO Encounter. And it is one of the most interesting UFO stories that I personally have ever run across. And it was investigated by some of the real heavyweights in the field at that time, including J. Allen Hynek, whom those of you who are here for Stanton Friedman's morning presentation, he mentioned Dr. Hynek as being one of the most legitimate of the scientists who were investigating UFOs in the 1960s, 70s, and so forth. So J. Allen Hynek considered this to be one of the strongest points of evidence to support the theory that some UFOs are extraterrestrial craft. And this story is very intriguing. It has firsthand eyewitness testimony from two of the individuals involved. It has the sighting of two different kind of craft and two different kinds of beings, as you're about to find out as the story unfolds. Okay. Let's see if we can advance the next slide here. I'm going to set the stage for you. This is not a Texas story. This happened in California. My co-author, with whom I wrote the book Mexico's Roswell and also The Other Roswell, is Ruben Uriarte, and he lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. And he and I have worked together on many UFO projects and also have spoken at a number of events throughout the country. We also have spoken at the annual Roswell UFO Festival. So as you can see on this map, here is the area where Ruben lives. And then just north of there is Sacramento, where part of the story I'm going to tell you today took place. And then over here, heading up toward Reno, right in here where you see this green shaded area, that is the area where this incident happened. It's a very rugged wilderness, forested area. It actually, the place where it happened and some of the events that took place resemble in a lot of ways the Travis Walton story, which you're going to hear later this afternoon and evening. Which is one of the most remarkable UFO stories that I, you know, had ever heard prior to this one as well, both being extremely interesting. So so we're talking about near Sacramento, and then in this area right here between Sacramento and Reno. And sometimes I do this presentation at conferences and events, and somebody in the audience will raise their hand and say, "Hey, I know that place. I've been hiking out there." So, in fact, my good friend Stephen Androsko, who gave the presentation this morning on South Texas X-Files, has actually been there himself. My co-author Ruben has been, but I haven't personally gone so yet. Okay, so basically the story is These three guys who worked in Sacramento at a big government contracting firm called Aerojet Corporation. Now, those of you who listened to Stanton Friedman this morning, you heard him mention Aerojet as being one of the companies that he worked for when he was employed in doing government defense contracting work on nuclear-powered rocket engines and also nuclear shielding. So Aerojet was one of the companies that Stanton Friedman consulted for as a nuclear physicist. And back in the 1960s, 1964, when this happened, Aerojet's big plant, where they conducted a lot of their rocket and missile building activities, was in Sacramento, California. And the three gentlemen who took part in this story were all three employed by the Aerojet Corporation. Our principal eyewitness with whom we wrote the book, whose story we tell in the book, was a gentleman named Donald Shrum. And he was 28 years old at the time this happened. He still lives today. He's in his late 70s. And he gave us permission to disclose his story for the first time in complete detail, naming all of the names and telling all of the information for the first time ever, the only time that his story has ever been officially told with all the information contained. And that was in the book that Ruben Uriarte and I co-wrote called Aliens in the Forest. Donald Shrum is the principal eyewitness. And also on that hunting trip that weekend was a gentleman named Vincent Alvarez. Mr. Alvarez gave sworn eyewitness written testimony that he saw the initial entry into the area of the large mothership, which Mr. Shrum testified to, a large disc-shaped object, 150 feet in diameter, that moved extremely fast. At one point, it was hovering just a few hundred feet from Mr. Shrum's position, and a second later, it looked like a star up in the sky. That's how fast it moved. And the third member of the hunting expedition that day was a gentleman named Tim Trueblood. Mr. Trueblood has never given a comprehensive statement of what, you know, what his feelings were about what happened. He did state that he could tell that Mr. Shrum had been through a very traumatic experience. In fact, he suffered the symptoms of someone who has post-traumatic stress syndrome, Mr. Shrum did, following his ordeal, which lasted 12 hours, by the way. So Mr. Trueblood has never given a formal statement. He developed psychological problems afterward. He had great fears, as all three men actually did. Mr. Shrum experienced terrible nightmares. He would wake up at night shaking in cold sweat, re-visualizing in his mind the experience that he went through and the strange beings that attempted to abduct him that night. This was investigated, as I mentioned, by many, many famous UFO investigators of the 1960s, including J. Allen Hynek and also James Harding, and a number of other people of very high credential, all of whom felt that the story, they held the story in high esteem and felt it was very likely completely true as Mr. Shrum told it. I've spent a lot of time talking to the witness, and he's a down-to-earth, credible person, just an everyday normal person, and he doesn't espouse any strange philosophical views about his experience. He simply tells what he underwent, what he experienced, what his feelings were, what he observed the strange creatures doing around him. He just tells it the way it happens and leaves all the speculating and conjecture and philosophizing to other people. He's just a very simple, nuts and bolts kind of guy. So in partnering with my friend Ruben Uriarte from California on writing of this book, the way this happened was when the story first happened in September 1964, Mr. Strum was employed by the United States primary missile and rocket defense contractor, Aerojet. And because he was under U.S. government contract, you know, he was under oath of secrecy, and security was very tight at the plant, and they were always warning employees really to not call attention to themselves in their private lives because of the secret nature of the work that they were doing. So Mr. Shrum did not feel comfortable after he experienced the story, these events, coming out and holding a press conference and saying, hey, this is what happened. So he never told his story in a formal sense to the general public. He told it to a few UFO investigators with the contingency that they wouldn't use his name. So that's the background, basically. And once again, the date is September 4th, 1964. That was a Friday. They had a long weekend. And the three men from Aerojet Corporation went out to the Tahoe National Forest, this highway between Sacramento and Reno. They went off the highway and they hiked. They left their vehicle parked in a parking area, and then they hiked on down and established a base camp near the Loch Leven Lakes. Okay? And then the three men... During the course of the evening, during the course of the day on Friday, they had Friday off. We're planning to be there Friday and Saturday and return home to Sacramento on Sunday. So the three men came down very rugged territory, lots of ravines, lots of pine trees, very difficult to move through. My co-author, Ruben Uriarte, just recently went down there just a few weeks ago, and he said that it's still as barren and, I mean, as rugged and as difficult to traverse as when this incident happened in 1964. So the three men came on down this way, and they kind of separated. Each one went his own way as they approached down. This is very rugged wilderness. And then they finally, Mr. Shrum, when he had his encounter with these strange craft and these strange beings, was right in this general area right here. There are no roads to get there. It's just strictly hard hiking and lots of it. Very rugged wilderness area, as I mentioned. This is what Mr. Shrum, who was 26 years old at the time this picture was taken, this is what he looked like. He was employed by Aerojet Corporation, as I've mentioned. And this is a drawing or a sketch that Mr. Shrum did of the area. Remember I mentioned that they set up camp near the Loch Leven Lakes, and then they came down this rugged, rugged area, heavy brush. And then the incident, interestingly enough, this pine tree that Mr. Shrum put here to represent most of what I'm going to describe in his UFO encounter happened there, right around this pine tree, which actually becomes instrumental to the story. So the men had been hunting. They got separated from each other. They kind of went their own way. To hear Mr. Shrum tell it, there wasn't much to shoot at that evening, maybe an acre or two. But there wasn't much in the way of game. They were bow and arrow hunting. I don't think I had emphasized that. It wasn't rifle season yet, so the men from time to time would go out bow and arrow hunting. So there wasn't much to shoot at. And they all had an agreement that if they became separated from each other, they couldn't make it back to base camp, they would look for a secure place to rest for the night. Maybe in a rocky ledge of boulders, or perhaps as Mr. Shrum chose to do, up in a tree, because of the frequent bear sightings and occasional bear attacks that had been reported in this area, as well as other predators. So something very strange happened once Mr. Shrum decided that he had picked a place and he was by this tree, he was going to spend the night there. And then he saw this incredible sight moving toward him. And if you can look at this picture on the right, he caught a glimpse of this bright object kind of in a distance. He was down here, and he was looking up to the north, northeast, and he saw this object kind of meandering across here. And he said, you'll hear in the video clip in a minute, it looked like someone walking up at the top of the ridge carrying a lantern. You know, well, it looked kind of small at that point, but then it made this turn and started coming toward him. Because at first, his impression was that maybe his two hunting companions, after they became separated, had contacted the Forest Service, and they had sent a helicopter after him to find him. So he thought maybe it was a rescue helicopter. And we're going to listen to his description.
And then I saw a light. It looked like a lantern going up and down a trail. But then it came over the top of a tree. And I got kind of excited then because I thought it was a helicopter from the Forest Service. And I stood between two of the fires that I built on the rocks, and waved my arms and yelled and screamed and finally that light started coming towards me. So I was really relieved then because I thought it was a helicopter still. Until it got within, maybe 60 feet or yards. I'm not sure the distance at night. But it just stood, hovered there with no sound. So then I panicked because I knew it was no helicopter. I thought it was something from outer space. But it looked like all I could see is a little, about an 8-inch glow. So I thought it was just a little tiny this, you know, flying saucer. And then I kind of panicked, and I threw my bow up in the tree again and hand walked out there that limb and got up in the tree. And I had all camouflage clothing on, so I figured, well, they won't see me here, you know. But then this light went a half circle around me over the canyon. Then I could see the shadow of the whole spacecraft. And that was just a light that was on the nose of it.
Okay, the design is very interesting that he describes. And he has sketched this out for us and for other UFO investigators. The object was 150 feet from edge to edge. It was cylindrical shaped, or almost, you could say, pill shaped. And at first, because the hull was generally dark, or very, you know, kind of blended with the night sky, he couldn't tell that there was substance to the hull. I mean, in other words, he couldn't see the solidity of the hull. He was only seeing this light. These three portals or windows did not open until later in the encounter. So at first, if you can imagine, all of this was totally dark and he was seeing only the small light. So at first he thought it was some little small object, you know, flittering around. And, you know, you heard him say, if it was a UFO, it was a real tiny one. But then as it came closer, it came past his position and it kind of hovered over this canyon or ravine just a short distance from where he was. And then he realized he hadn't been seeing the whole extent of the object. It was massive. That's like a 12-story building turned on its side. So now this is very interesting because, as you'll hear in a minute, he continued watching this strange object from his position. He was up in the tree, in a pine tree. He had a military-style belt with canteen, so he strapped that to one of the larger branches to secure his position up in the tree. And he continued to watch this incredible object. Here in this, this is a copy of the drawing that Mr. Shrum did, where he describes the object. This was a small light, again, that he initially saw. and then these three panels. And in a while, you're going to listen to him talk about a smaller ship, which he refers to as the scout ship, that came out of one of these three panels, the middle panel, which opened up as he observed the craft. This is an artistic representation of this huge cylindrical object hovering just a short distance at about eye level from Mr. Shrum's position in that tree. And just showing the route again. Now, here is Mr. Shrum's description of how the three panels suddenly glowed into life, opened up, and out of the middle one shot out this smaller object.
And then I saw three panels of light, like windows or whatever. And I saw a flash come from the bottom of the center one, and just saw a dark object go down to in the canyon, and then I lost track of it. And then the next thing I saw was a little blinking light up on the top of originally where the first one came from.
This object that you first saw that left the center panel, what did it look like, Don?
Well, at that time, all I saw was a flash and saw a dark object go down.
The dark object, what shape was it?
Well, I couldn't really say. It went so fast. But then I saw when it landed up on the ridge that it, I could see like a half, I could only see part of the top, but it had a little light on it and looked like the top of a flying saucer. Really? That I'd seen in pictures.
Like a dome? Or
yes. Yeah, like a dome. And then I kept my eyes on that.
Okay, so just to kind of recap what he's talking about, there was this huge craft, 150 feet in diameter, hovering just a short distance from his position, and out of the center panel, right over here, and out of the center panel came this smaller craft, which zoomed across past him and landed at a distance away from him. This was an area of heavy brush between him and where the second object, landed. And then these strange beings came from the direction of the smaller ship. Mr. Shrum heard them kind of crashing through the brush, through the undergrowth, and getting closer to his position. And this is what he has to say.
And I heard some thrashing through the brush, and probably 5-10 minutes, these two humanoids come out of the brush, and they kind of broke some of the brush off and was looking at it. And then they came straight underneath the tree and looked up at me. And I knew right then I was fingered.
They found you.
Yeah, they found me.
Can you describe them for us? Tell us briefly what
they. Yeah, they were looked like 4 to 5 feet. Of course, I'm looking down at them, so they'd be shorter than they probably are. And they had a silvery, like a one-piece suit on, and it seemed like it had the joints, puffy joints, you know, on the shoulders and the elbows and the legs. I didn't see that clear.
The humanoids, were you able to see their faces?
No, it was just a kind of a dark shadow. I could see the two like eyes that were looked like welding goggles to me. They were the same as welding goggles, and then the rest of the face was kind of blur. I couldn't see looking down at them.
You're able to see then was it large or small? They're
about 2 inches in diameter. It reminded me just like I said, like a welding goggles.
Okay. I just want to add that we were very fortunate to have a very talented artist who did the artwork for our book, did the sketches based on Mr. Shrum's testimony. Mr. Neil Reby, who does a lot of illustration work and does graphic novels, and he's a big Godzilla fan, by the way. Anybody here like Godzilla? Okay, a few do. That kind of dates us, I think. Godzilla isn't as popular anymore. Anyway, Neil Reby did all of the illustrations. If you all would like to pick up a copy of Aliens in the Forest, you'll see his amazing work on the sketches. And all of them, you know, we showed them to Mr. Shrum, the eyewitness, prior to publishing the book, and he was just astonished because this was the closest visual representation of what he went through that he had ever seen any artist put down. So he was amazed. Okay, so then a second type of creature arrived, even more bizarre than the first. Mr. Shrum refers to this second being as a robot. But he emphasized to us when we interviewed him that this doesn't necessarily mean that this second type of being was a robot or a mechanical being, but simply that it looked like one. It was about the same shape, size, and general description as the humanoids, what Mr. Shrum called the humanoids. So perhaps it was just one of the humanoids in a different type of bulkier suit. So we don't know for certain if this was a distinctly different type of entity or whether it was simply one of the humanoids in a different type of specially adapted suit. So this is the initial description that Mr. Shrum gave right after his sighting. And then this is an enhancement that was done by NICAP investigator Paul Cerny, who was the original investigator in this case. And this is what Mr. Shrum had to say about this robot.
And then I saw two flashing red-orange light eyes just picking its way down the ridge, just between the rocks and around them and everything, and come down and was on this big boulder, this big flat rock. And then he kind of looked up at me and he moved his hand through the fire cinders and kind of scattered them.
And the eyes of this other creature, like the robot, what did that look like to you?
And it had kind of like fire. It's kind of a orangish, reddish orange, or yellowish orange. And it kind of flickered like fire. And they're about the same diameter as about 2 inches in diameter as the humanoids.
Okay. This interview that you're watching video clips from was conducted by my co-author Ruben Uriarte about 6 or 7 years ago. It was one of the initial interviews with the eyewitness. Unfortunately, in the years since, he has developed Parkinson's disease and now has a lot of difficulty speaking clearly. So we were very lucky to get the entire story on videotape before this medical condition, you know, began to hamper his ability to communicate. But what's very interesting to me is I took this video interview that Ruben, my co-author, did, and I transcribed it on paper, word for word, and I compared it with the transcription of, or the transcribed version of a testimony that Mr. Shrum gave in 1964 to an investigator from NICAP, the National Investigation Committee on Aerial Phenomenon. And even though that was 1964 and this one was like 2005, the descriptions, the way he described things, the descriptions of the entities, the descriptions of the ships matched 100%. So, I mean, it is burned or engraved in his memory, the events that happened that night. So then something very strange happened to moving the story along. The second type of being, which appeared more mechanical than organic, suddenly he moved right to the base of the tree where Mr. Shrum was, and the hand seemed to reach for some kind of mechanism around the mouth, what we would consider the mouth area, and then a jet of gas, some kind of vapor, shot upward and started drifting up into the tree where Mr. Shrum was located.
Then he come down up on the rock. He was about 7 feet from me. And then he touched his mouth and kind of a steam vapor come out of his mouth, and it lit up his face so I could see some detail. And then I blacked out when that steam hit me, or I guess it was kind of took the air from me, and I'd gasp for air and then black out. And I fell over my bow. And that's the only thing that kept me in the tree. And then, so I figured they were out to get me then.
So, given that these strange visitors had made their first, what you would interpret as a hostile move, they were obviously trying to get at him, or that's how he interpreted it. He suddenly, became very, very much into a survival mode of thinking. And he was, from then on and for the next approximately 12 hours, he was locked in the mode of surviving this somehow, some way, so he could get back to his family, to his wife, to his young daughter. And really the only kind of weapons that he had at his disposal was his bow and three arrows is all he had remaining. So this was these guys obviously had a technology beyond what was available on Earth in 1964. And he was there with the most primitive of weapons, which was a bow and arrow. And we've actually talked to people who hold the theory that if the Earth is ever invaded by a higher, more advanced species, going low tech might actually be a way to cause significant damage to this technologically superior race that would try to take over the Earth. So, hiding out, using guerrilla tactics, hiding underground, using the lowest technology possible to fight back, some people feel would be the most effective means of combating invading aliens. Well, Mr. Shrum didn't have any choice in the matter. All he had at his disposal was low tech. So he shot his arrows, as we'll hear in this next clip.
So I had a 60-pound bow, which is a very high velocity. And I shot, seeing how the robot's the only thing that was causing me harm, I shot the chest area. And it has the velocity of a rifle at that distance, because I'm only about 7-8 feet from him. And it, when I hit the chest, the sparks would fly like electrical, like an arc welder kind of. And then that robot backed up and almost knocked him down. He kind of fell back against a rock, and the two at the bottom took off and headed for the brush and stood out there about 30 feet from me. And then I shot two more arrows, and about the same time sequence that these two humanoids would, every time I'd shoot, they'd go back up into the brush, just almost out of sight from me.
So he was, you know, kind of causing them some confusion or frustration temporarily, but there wasn't any damage, of course, that was being done by his crude weapons. So basically, the onslaught would continue for many hours more. This is the actual bow that Mr. Shrum used in the incident. He showed some of the artifacts from his encounter. He showed them to Reuben during the interviews that we did. So, having expended his three arrows, his only choice now was to, you know, use whatever means at his disposal. He was trying to think of every possible means to at least slow down the attack on him, the attempts to grab him out of the tree. And one of the things he thought to do, because he had a lot of matches, as a hunter, he always carried lots of matches. He thought about setting branches from the tree on fire and throwing them down. He thought about lighting parts of his clothing on fire and throwing it down, and hopefully catch some of the vegetation around the base of the tree on fire. And maybe, you know, something that had happened earlier during the initial approach of the aliens kind of gave him the idea that perhaps they might be afraid of fire. So he attempted to do this.
Then I ran out of arrows, so I only had three left. And that's when pomade hair, is just, I mean, the cap I had on was just soaked with oil.
This is for your hair?
Yeah, from my hair, yeah, 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 pomade. And I always carried all kinds of books of matches with me when I hunted. And so I lit that cap, and it just blazed up, and I dropped it down the base of the tree. And just in that instant, they moved back about 12, 15 feet, and I glanced over at the ship that was over the canyon, kind of almost level with me, and it was almost out of sight. It was just like a star. It moved that fast.
Wow.
Just in that second. So then I got the idea that they're scared of fire, so I burned everything but my t-shirt and my jeans. And come to find out later on that it was 32 degrees out, and I was shaking and kind of overexposed for the weather. And I had a bunch of change, and I threw it down, and they all kind of gathered around it. Well, after I shot my or started burning stuff and throwing it down, and I even tied some of my shirt that I ripped up to a compass so I could try to hit some brush, because there wasn't nothing right underneath the tree. And then I caught a little pile of brush on fire. I figured that would bring the cavalry. That when I run out of stuff to burn, I headed for the top of the tree. And then it was a pretty sparse tree. I could see down to the ground. And I broke off the top and threw it down. And anytime I throw down or shake the tree, these humanoids would back up.
Okay, so the fire was causing these strange entities to back away for a while, but then they would come right back. And they would continue this process of trying to gas him and apparently bring him down from the tree. So here's some sketches done by the eyewitness. As you can see, the size, shape of the two entities that he saw are very similar. This was the entity that he refers to as being a humanoid. And then this is the entity he describes as being a robot or robotic. So once again, we're not clear if this was two different types of beings or simply two different suits or two different clothing types. Okay, and this was the initial sketch. This was one of the later sketches of the scene that Mr. Shrum did. This is the tree, and that's his representation of himself holding the bow and arrow, the large ship hovering over the ravine. And what's very interesting in talking to Mr. Shrum is he heard a series of strange noises. He at first thought it was bird song. He thought it was maybe owls or other kinds of night birds. But then after a while, he began to notice that when he heard the sound, shortly afterward, the entities would do something different. They would change their course of action. Like, for example, the sounds would happen and then the two humanoids would attempt to climb the tree, and he'd have to kick at them and throw stuff down, throw pieces of the tree at them, shake the tree to try to get them from not being able to climb up. So after a while, he thought, and in thinking about it since, he thinks that perhaps this was a method of communication between the entities. And this is what he says in this clip.
Did you hear any noise between them? Any communication? Was there any?
You know, I heard kind of a cooing or almost like an owl. But it could have been an owl, you know, that up there. But it just kind of fit in with them.
So when you heard this owl-like sound, what did they do?
Well, they'd go on about their business, you know, what they were. But they would try to climb up the tree. They're trying to boost each other up the tree, and then when I would, that's why I know I wasn't out very long at a time, because when I'd throw something down or when I was being gassed, they'd step back from the tree, and then they'd be, when I'd come to, I'd have dry heaves and kind of gasp for air, and they'd just be trying to climb back up on the tree. So that gave me a time that I wasn't out very long.
Okay, so the story is getting near its conclusion now. Mr. Shrum was locked in this ordeal for hours. The creatures would try different methods to try to get to him in the tree. He would resist them. He would kick at them. He would throw stuff at them. They would attempt to gas him with some kind of vapor that dispelled all the oxygen from the air and caused him to black out temporarily. So all these methods were being tried. And he was convinced, he is to this day, you know, we've been on talk shows and callers have called in saying, well, maybe he misunderstood these beings' motives. Maybe they were actually friendly and just, well, Mr. Shrum is very, very much convinced that his life was in peril. And if he did not succeed in overcoming this challenge, he would never see his family again. There was this overwhelming feeling that he was, that his life as he knew it was about to expire unless he was able to somehow survive this night. So this went on, you know, as I say, all night. And then something really unusual happened. There was a totally new strategy on the part of the entities, as we're going to hear in this clip.
After I went to the top of the tree, I had a military belt, And I moved it out to the last hitch and put it around me and the tree. So in case I did get gassed, they wouldn't I wouldn't fall down. And then, like I said, I threw chains down and everything to try to distract them. And then finally, these two humanoids stepped back from the tree, and another robot came, and there was two just about the same place that the two humanoids were. And they stood facing each other, and the flames just like lightning, and it real bright, and it just came between them. And the gas was so thick coming up the tree that it would dissipate just about the time I got to me. But then that's when I'd start to gasp for air. And then when I woke up from that, it was light, but the sun hadn't come up yet. And I was just hanging by my belt, my head down, my feet down, and they were gone. Well, I knew I made it. I lived through the night.
Just to go back, did you fall asleep, or this gas, did it overwhelm you?
Yeah, that's when it completely engulfed the whole tree and got up to me, and at I don't know how long I was out, but it was just you could see just a dim glow of the sun on the clouds and stuff, not clouds, but in the sky. And then when I woke up, it was light, but the sun hadn't come up yet.
So he was just hanging from the tree by his military belt. Mr. Shrum told us that for years he worried that after this final gassing, when he passed out for the last time, from that time until he awoke, he didn't know what had happened or how long that period of time was. He didn't know if perhaps they had actually gotten to him and done something to him, maybe even removed him from the tree, done things, and then brought him back and placed him back in his original position. He was very concerned about that. Until a few years later, Paul Cerny, the lead investigator in this case for NICAP, suggested that he undergo regressive hypnotherapy. And through hypnotherapy, Mr. Shrum, it was established that following this last blackout, the beings never reached him. He remembered other interesting details that he hadn't, in his fully conscious mind, had never been able to bring forth. But under hypnotherapy, he remembered small details like the massive size of the mothership, 150 feet in diameter. Also, he remembered that there were what looked like footsteps. It looked like a child wearing moccasin, the type of footsteps that would be made by a child wearing moccasins, all around the base of the tree after he got down, you know. But anyway, through the hypnotherapy sessions, he became convinced in his own mind that he had never been reached by the entities. So this was the original sketch, by the way, that Mr. Shrum did right after the incident. It's a very unique story. It's unlike any other that I had ever heard of. It has a lot of interesting little nuances and details that would indicate that someone like Mr. Shrum would just not make something like this up out of nowhere, you know, just because he was interested in telling a yarn or something. He wasn't that kind of person. And Vincent Alvarez gave written testimony that he saw the initial entry into the area of the 150-foot wide mothership. And as I stated earlier, Tim Trueblood, the other gentleman, this is Mr. Trueblood, this is Mr. Alvarez, this is what Mr. Shrum looked like back then. Mr. Trueblood never gave us a formal statement. And then there was the Air Force. The Air Force came. Air Force officers were dispatched to talk to Mr. Shrum. He thought they were from the local base. Later, when NICAP and MUFON did some searching, it turned out they had been sent to him from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base near Dayton, Ohio, which many people say was a hotbed of government UFO activities in the 1960s. So they came all the way from Ohio to interview Mr. Shrum, but they weren't really there to collect data. They were actually there to discourage him from taking the belief that this was anything strange or out of the ordinary. They were trying to convince him that, for example, they floated a lot of scenarios to him, that maybe it was a Boy Scout troop that was out in the forest, and they were just having fun with him, you know, playing a prank with him. And then they said, you know, maybe it was some Japanese prisoners of war that had gotten loose and are still living out there in the forests all these years. And all kinds of bizarre explanations they attempted to plant in his brain. We're going to hear just a short clip about that. Well, that one's not triggering, so let me see if I can click on it. Well, but basically that's what he had to say. I think my slideshow is okay. All right. Well, I'm going to take a few questions. We don't have a great deal of time. It's a very interesting case, one of the best cases that I personally have run across. It's one that's not very well known because Mr. Shrum refused to have his actual name used all those years because he was fearful. And it is only until recently that he disclosed full details and the names of everybody involved. So this, you know, because it was anonymous, a lot of people didn't take it seriously. But then when you go back and do the research and find that it was a legitimate case investigated by many of the top UFO researchers of that era, then you realize this was an amazing event. So, and Mrs. Shrum, who did the foreword to our book, Aliens in the Forest, unfortunately passed away just a few months ago. And we were very sorry. She helped us tremendously with, she wanted to, before she passed out, she was suffering with a long bout of cancer. And she wanted, before she passed away, that the true story of her husband's experience go out to the world. So I remember her son took pictures of the day the boxes of our book arrived at their house. We sent them a box full of complimentary copies. And her face was just so lit up in those pictures. And that was just a few weeks before she passed away. So anyone have questions? I can take just a couple about this strange incident or anything at all that you'd like to ask or comment about. Yes, ma'am. Yes, if I hadn't run out of time, there's a whole nother part, what you can read about in Aliens in the Forest, about the investigation. The fact that there was clear evidence that after these Wright-Patterson investigators came to talk to Mr. Shrum, the Air Force actually went out there and they found evidence. They went out there to the scene and did a thorough investigation, and they raked the ground for a large diameter distance all around the base of that tree that Mr. Shrum was in. So they did as thorough of a job as possible of collecting all the scraps of any possible evidence. So Mr. Shrum was asking if they were trying to do so hard to discredit my story and tell me that what I experienced was nothing out of the ordinary, why did they send an entire task force out to where this happened to clean up the scene? You know, that's one thing that he never understood. And there's a lot more to it. There was many more investigations by NICAP and MUFON and A lot of interesting stuff. Yes, another question. The question is, could this encounter have been somehow linked to their employment with the missile defense contractor, Aerojet? Maybe they were trying to find out what telepathically or linking to their minds, what kind of missile and rocket systems Mr. Shrum was involved in. Yeah, that's a very good thought, and that's not a question that that ever came up in our conversations, but it's intriguing because of the fact that it happened there and the people involved in it were all Aerojet employees. Yes, very good question. One more back there, sir. Yeah, hypnotherapy. Yeah, there are pros and cons, and you have to have someone who's certified, who's a medically trained person. It can't be just Joe, who belongs to the Mutual UFO Network, who's conducting this because he read how to do it on the internet, you know. But these were all highly credentialed people that were involved in Mr. Shrum. And really, the hypnotherapy that was done on Mr. Shrum did not disclose any earth-shattering new information. Everything that I told you today came out of his sworn testimony given right after the event and then revisited by us many years later. The only thing that came out of the hypnotherapy with Mr. Shrum was that he himself, within himself, he developed a sense of peace. He developed the realization that the aliens never got to him. That's really the only thing that there was no additional details or information that could have been suggested to him because the testimony had already been given and had been written down by NICAP. So there was no additional details other than a couple of things, the footprints and the size of the ship. One last question, and then we have to make way for Mr. Stanton Friedman. Yes, sir. Yes, all three of the men split up. One of them made it back to base camp. The other one found a shelter of some kind in a rocky area. And so they didn't get back together until the following day. And I really didn't have time to delve into what happened the morning after the encounter. But it's all in the book if you are interested in getting that. Thank you very much. You've been a great audience.
Thank you.